Today on Deep Dive into Water Safety, we're joined by Jamie McMahon, a leading researcher whose focuses on how people experience and survive rip currents in real world conditions. He's a professor of oceanography at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey Bay. With coastal drowning remaining a critical issue worldwide, including here in Hawaii, this conversation is especially timely. Today, we'll explore what research tells us about rip currents, why traditional messaging sometimes fails, and how new approaches can help both locals and visitors respond more effectively when caught in one. So, thank you for joining us, Dr. McMahon. I'm very excited about this because I don't really think I know very much about rip currents. And I read the article, Everything in Outside Magazine. Everything you know about surviving rip currents is wrong. So why don't we start with that? Why don't we start with the question I have? You've spent years studying rip currents as a physical ocean process. What do people most misunderstand about how rip currents actually work?
Yeah, this is a very loaded question. And the problem with rip currents are they're complex. They're not just a simple message that we can describe their description. And in a way to do that, we have oversimplified the messaging to the point that the brochures kind of show it as this river that goes through the ocean. And that oversimplification makes it where people think they'll see a river in the ocean and they never see the river in the ocean. So some of it is we're trying to get messaging to beachgoers, but then we've oversimplified the message in a way. And rip currents, as I said, are a bit complex. And they come in different shapes and sizes. So every beach has a different type of rip current. All beaches have rip currents. And oftentimes, the portion of the rip current that's often seen is the one that exits the wave breaking. But the wave breaking area, which we refer to as the surf zone, is quite wide. That can be 75 meters to 100 meters. And the bubbles and the breaking that are going on there, unless you have a trained eye, you will not see the presence of a rip current. It's only when they exit the surf zone do you see the transport of bubbles and sediment that makes it easier to recognize a rip current occurred there. But it turns out that rip currents, when they exit the surf zone, this is a relatively episodic phenomena. So you will see it for a short duration, but then over time, you'll see another rip current down the beach pulse and go out. And so there's a lot of variability, both spatially and temporally, that goes on with this. And inside the surf zone, with all the bubbles and the wave breaking happening, you don't even think there's a current out there. And so explaining this to a beachgoer and their, the idea of their attention that they're going to spend to understand the ocean environment is quite difficult. And so we have these short messaging that people like will see in the corner of their eye, and they generally see this notion that it looks like a river that's going offshore. And if they don't see this river, they're probably okay. And the messaging needs to change and be more realistic than what's currently going on. That's a start when we'll get into the details and the features of rip currents and how this plays into what a rip current is, the naming, and how to actually to respond to a rip current.
Right, because I think most people now think they should swim parallel to the beach, swim parallel to beach, stay calm, and swim parallel to the beach. And everybody I know is just panic thinking about a rip current. So let's talk about how you came to this understanding with your, evidence-based, science-based research about rip current.
Okay, so there was a few things, few nuggets you were asking in that, and we should start with those first, with the rip current being dangerous. A lot of people, again, because of the brochures, show a rip current as like parting the ocean, that their speeds are so fast it just separates the ocean. And this is a misnomer. This is inaccurate. Rip current speeds are often not that fast. They can get up to speeds of a meter per second, but they're generally less than a meter per second. And so most people don't know what a meter per second, translate that into something that's meaningful. But a meter per second would say, if the surf zone width is 100 meters, that's most of the from the shoreline to the distance offshore where the waves are breaking, is typically 75 meters to 100 meters, so a football field. And the maximum speed would be 1 meter per second. And if you do the quick math on that, that says to go across the entire football field, it would take about 2 minutes. 2 minutes is a very long time. That is not fast. So the speeds are not dangerous. Most rivers are faster than rip currents. And people go tubing and swimming in rivers all the time without any fear whatsoever. There's a fear when you get closer to a rapid or to rocks or a waterfall. Yes, those are dangerous, but the river itself looks pretty benign and you float downstream and really you don't feel anything at all. There's no issue with the speed of the river as you float downstream. And if you're tubing and floating down with a river and you see an area that's beachy and sandy that you want to get out of the river and just enjoy being on land, you start to make your way over to that side of the river. Now, if you overshoot it, you didn't time it well to start swimming across the river, it's only then when you pass the spot and you start swimming back upriver that you start to go, I'm not making any progress. And fear and panic may start to set in because now you've overshot the spot. You're trying to swim to the location you want to go to. But now you are feeling this invisible force against your body that is not allowing you to make forward progress. Now, in a river, it's not bad because you could just float downstream a little bit more and get to another bank and just walk back up once you're on land to a sandy beach. So you're dealing with the same thing in the ocean, but now you're moving away from the safety part of the shoreline. The first part of the rip current is moving you offshore, and that starts to become unsettling. The other thing I'm going to use with a river analogy is when you walk across a river and it's shallow, only then do you feel the flow against your ankles and your legs. And as you get deeper, you would feel more of a force against your body as you try to keep your feet on the bottom of the river. But once you start floating, you don't feel that anymore. There's no force. You're just a floating object at that point. And that's what a rip current does. You're not going to feel anything that pulls on you. You will only feel a pull on your body when you're in shallow enough water that you feel it against your feet and your waist because your feet are on the sand. Rip currents, we'll get into the complexity, but they are in the deeper part of the surf zone. It's called a rip channel. And part of the mechanism for the formation of a rip current is that there's a deeper part and a shallower part. You need both components to create a rip current. The rip current portion that goes offshore is in the deeper channel. And so a lot of times people will stand close to shore. Waves have a lot of variability. They come in set waves or groupie. And so a lot of times people don't realize, but every wave that kind of picks your body up allows the underlying current to move you around. And with each wave kind of picking you up off the seabed, before too long, you may be in deeper water in the rip current. And at this point, it's still not fast, but time has a way of making things, if you don't take action quickly, 10 seconds becomes 30 seconds, and 30 seconds becomes 60 seconds. And now, 60 seconds, you're halfway across the football field. In, 120 seconds, you are now at the edge of the football field. So if you're having a conversation, you're not paying attention, you're floating around a little bit, all of a sudden this time integrates and it moves you further from what you feel safe. And if you're not comfortable with that environment, panic and fear kicks in. And the problem is there at this point, you're not in a dangerous scenario. You're just floating. You're just deeper than what you can touch the bottom. But because the signage shows danger, 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 and the way that they show the danger now creates a panic for someone where most people, if they just said, I'm in a river, I'm just floating, it'll be okay, can overcome that and you will be safe. It's just that inherent nature of the unknown and the safety spot of being the shoreline is our friend, and everyone feels that is the spot. And when you're moved away from it invisibly, you start to freak out. What was your second part? Sorry, that was just.
No, I'm just trying to envision this myself because most people think they get caught in a rip, and we have rivers here that come down from the mountains, and so when we have a lot of rain, they're very forceful and they pull people out. And there's
Yes.
no real beach; there's rocky cliffs. But getting back to my point, that most people think I'm going to get caught in this rip, like you say, and now I'm really far out. And it's going to take me all the way to Japan. You know, we're out in the
Yes,
middle,
yes.
and they just think I'm. It's I. There's nothing. I got to get start swimming. I got to start swimming,
Yes.
and I got to sw start swimming parallel to the shore. And you know, there's information and research now that I know you're part of, and you can talk about how you've done your research with this GPS work, but.
Yeah, okay. Let's talk about the components of a rip current and how we learn what a rip current actually does and what it truly is doing, particularly in the invisible part of the wave breaking. Okay, so rip currents, and this is where as a scientist and a physicist, we try to keep the language as minimal as possible so that people can understand.
Thank
But
you.
rip currents primarily form with differences in wave breaking. And this is also how you spot rip currents. So what you need, so waves break in twice their water depth. So if you have a 1 meter wave, it breaks in 2 meters. You have a 3 feet wave, it breaks in 6 feet. And what happens is you need shallower regions where the wave is breaking, and you need deeper locations where the wave is not breaking. And there is a feedback mechanism that occurs between the waves and the circulation and the sand, but these together create a sand bar morphology that is common on almost all sandy coasts, where you have a shallower shoal and a deeper rip channel. On the shallower shoal, the waves will break, or sandbar, shoal or sandbar. So the waves will break on the sandbar, and they won't break as much in the rip channel. And that is the driver for causing the circulation, is this differential wave breaking. And the momentum and things I'm going to ignore drive a current from the area where the waves are breaking to the area where the waves are not breaking. And the big disconnect between what we observed and that was changing the messaging of how the Lifeguard Association was saying what you should do is that the currents are not this simple river that goes offshore in a 1D scenario. They are a complex circular, so a merry-go-round circulation, and there's multiple merry-go-rounds hidden beneath the breaking wave area. So it's not a simple river going offshore. It's much more complex than that. And because it's a merry-go-round, telling someone to swim parallel where they don't know where they are in the merry-go-round makes it very difficult because you could be swimming in the wrong direction in the merry-go-round. It's only when the rip current exits the surf zone, it gets out of the complexity of of becoming this merry-go-round to a single jet that goes offshore. At that point, if you're outside of wave breaking, swimming parallel is 100% accurate. Inside of wave breaking, swimming parallel is much more difficult to assess. The merry-go-rounds, it turns out, in the surf zone, they're not the same sizes. So you could have a bigger merry-go-round on the right side and a smaller merry-go-round on the left side. And because you don't know the size of the merry-go-rounds, it also influences which way you should swim because of this. We developed these GPS tracking drifters that float and in some ways represent a person floating. And we deployed 50 of these. And once you deploy these, instead of being invisible and not being able to see the currents in this wave-breaking area, we started seeing the trajectory of all of these drifters in the surf zone. And very quickly, your eye goes, look at all these merry-go-rounds going on in the surf zone. But before we did this drifter study, I was asked by NOAA and Sea Grant to help them make a video, and at the time of swim parallel. And I was an advocate of swim parallel. And we did this video in Monterey, California, and myself and another graduate student, they would have us go into the rip current. And then we got to a certain point and swim parallel. And they wanted this documentation of swimming parallel. And it was during this video, because this is the first time that I'm having to swim parallel for a 2-hour session where they're trying to constantly get video of this, that it became very apparent that if you swam parallel in one direction, it was extremely easy. Swimming parallel in the other direction was as difficult or more than trying to swim back to shore. And during this video, there were times we could never even swim parallel to get to the shallow sandbar to actually demonstrate it. And that's because the rip currents are not symmetric. They're asymmetric with these different merry-go-rounds going on. And it was at that point it really hit me following the study that telling someone to swim parallel in a circular circulation may be wrong. And it's a 50-50 chance that you could be swimming the wrong way. The other thing that we gained from our drifter study, as well as me putting a GPS on my head and just floating around, was that 80% of the time, we ended up back on shore because we were following this merry-go-round. The issue with this is that it takes about 3 minutes, and 3 minutes, and it could be longer than that, it could be 3 to 5 minutes, is a long time to tell someone to be idle. And the problem becomes is that as you go out the rip current, The rip current, because it's deeper, doesn't have the wave breaking. So you're actually relatively safe in benign water. But then as you take the Marigot and you go to the outer edge of the surf zone, and now it turns and starts coming back to shore, it's now going over the shallower parts where the waves are breaking. And now you're trying to stay afloat. And you're in the region where waves are breaking. And that is the danger part, because most people don't know how to handle waves breaking on their head as they have to take this journey back to shore. So the rip current itself is actually somewhat the safer spot because there's not as much wave breaking occurring. But the merry-go-round journey requires you to go back into the shallower area where the wave is breaking, and you don't realize it, but the current is actually faster going onshore than it is going offshore, because if you account for the continuity of mass, the rip channel's deep. And because it's deep, it goes slower, just like a river. The deeper part of the river is slower. And as you get shallower and shallower, it gets faster. Well, the sandbar is the fastest spot or the shallowest spot, so it actually is faster. But at that point, no one cares because the waves are crashing all over your head. And if you're one of the unlucky ones, the rip current will squirt you out into the ocean. And now at that point, you want to swim parallel to get out from stop going further offshore. But to make it back on shore, you got to go back through the surf zone and the wave breaking, which is another journey into itself of getting back to shore.
This is too complicated. I want a three-step method that if I'm caught in the rip in Hanalei Bay, that you explain to me the surf zone and the waves breaking and where I need to float. Maybe you could explain that to me. So.
Well, the yes, so I explained what a rip current is, and that's the complexity. That's
Yes.
the problem, and that's maybe one type and shape of rip current. The rip currents scale with wave height. So the sandbar morphology will create larger rip currents, larger spacing with bigger waves. Smaller waves will create different types of rip current spacing. You get rip currents over rocky reefs, headlands, anything
Right.
that creates this differential breaking, you get rip currents. So they come in all shapes and sizes. Generally, the messaging we find is that there should be different messaging for different beaches, meaning some rip currents, because they hit a headland, will always go offshore, don't create the merry-go-round, and swimming parallel to get out of it immediately is wise advice. The general concept that we're talking about is kind of sandy beaches away from structures. And my recommendation is that staying afloat. And since the conversation came up, it was always this thing that it's going to take you about 3 to 5 minutes and you are going to go through a wave breaking area. And that idle part was always a mental conflict in my messaging, because being passive is that's hard. But I do like Bruce's messaging of it be turning it into an active message, which is staying afloat,
Right.
and staying afloat and keeping your head high, you will end up back in shore 70 to 80% of the time. That you can't say 100%. That's the other problem with this, is there's variability in the rip currents that they could take you further offshore, And you have to swim parallel once you get outside of wave breaking. Inside of wave breaking, stay afloat. Outside of wave breaking, swim parallel, then swim back to shore.
So is the rip current going pretty fast inside or not? When the wave's breaking compared to if I just, it's hard
You
to
wouldn't
imagine.
know, you generally won't notice it. It's only when you swim against it will you have any idea of its difficulty. That's the other problem with a lot of beachgoers is they don't have a perception of where they went into the ocean and where they are in the ocean. Even on beaches without rip currents, that where the currents are predominantly along shore, a lot of beachgoers, you just casually are floated down the beach, and then you realize, oh, I'm way down the beach. I gotta walk back up to go to where my towel is. But if you were to try to swim or walk in the surf zone against that current, you would realize you can't make as much progress as you had hoped. But the nice thing with the alongshore current is you could just go at a different part. It's like the river. Now you just walk to shore and you walk back up the beach. So there's, and the other thing that you brought up is that there are many types of currents, and sometimes people misuse the terminology for them. So, and initially, as a scientist, when they said rip current or rip tide or undertow or I used to frown a little bit, but I don't frown as much as long as they have they may name it wrong, but if they know they may be in the scenario that requires them to get out of it, even if they call it the wrong name, who cares? As long as they can survive and get out of it, we can call them anything in the world afterwards, as long as the information was there. But yes, there's currents that move along the beach. Far from rip currents, there's undertow, which is cross shore where there's a flow primarily at the surface and a return flow at the bottom. None of these will pool. I remember as a kid, my parents saying, watch out for the undertow, like it was a sea monster that was going to suck you out to sea underneath. It's not going to do that. An undertow is not going to pull you out beneath the ocean. It's just a different type of current. It's actually relatively benign, relative to a rip current.
So I have a question because I read this all the time. Why do you think the idea that rip current victims are weak swimmers continues to persist despite the science?
I think it's not weak swimmers. I just think it's people that don't have knowledge of the ocean. And I think we think of tourists, and we think of tourists that, I don't think it's weak swimmers. I think you can take a strong athlete, and this has happened even with our studies. And even with the messaging that we have with our studies, it's panic. And even floating out in these rip currents with me and other colleagues and students, and there you can see different levels of panic depending on their familiarity with the ocean. Even with the idea that they know this is going to bring them back to shore. If you haven't been in the ocean very much, there's an unsettling feel when you're moving away from your security blanket, which is shallow water and the sandy beach.
Right.
I think you take any athlete and you put them in a scenario that they do not have familiarity with, mistakes will happen. And that's it's more knowledge than I think weaker swimmers. I do think sometimes people, especially, in California here, People dabble in the beach as tourists because the ocean's colder, and then they may have full clothing on, pants and a sweater, and any of garment that you have on is just going to work even against the strongest athlete.
Right.
I don't think athlete is the key. I think it's how you handle stress, your familiarity. And of course, if you are stronger, you probably have a higher probability. There's a realization of just being able to overcome things. And I think as athletes, you're put in scenarios that you kind of push yourself. So you kind of recognize you can be okay, where people who tend not to push themselves may find themselves that uncertainty will create more panic.
So if you tell me to float, Margaret, don't panic, float. And am I supposed to visualize if I float out through this rip current, past the break of the waves, that if it's a circular rip, then most of the times maybe it is it going to, is the current going to take me back in eventually? Can I have that scenario in my head?
So even in the scenario where you, so the rip current, so let's talk the rip current that exits the surf zone, it loses speed very quickly because the forcing mechanism for the rip current is the zone of wave breaking. The further you get away from the zone of wave breaking, the less that rip current dies pretty quickly. And because the rip current is ejecting water out into the ocean, that has to come back. Like, if not, the rip currents would empty the surf zone of water, which doesn't happen. So we did study this in follow-up ones looking more at the seaward part. There's a small trickle that comes back to shore. So most of the drifters, when we did this and we were shorthanded and deploying 50 of them, we're running all around the beach. We have people on the boat, and they would collect the drifters that would go offshore, and then we would gather them all and redeploy them in the rip current and do the study. The follow-on study was, let's let the drifters that go outside the surf zone, keep drifting. Where do they go? They slowly end up back at shore. But now you're talking 30 minutes. But because the rip current loses so much speed as it goes offshore, the corresponding currents coming back on the shore are equally slow. And so it just takes a longer time. However, floating outside of wave breaking is easier. If you have family members and people that saw you on the beach and recognize that if you ended up outside the surf zone, if you just stay afloat, people can visually see you generally a little better, and hopefully help can get there. Again, that depends on the beach. This, I'd say, the strongest recommendation that we have, regardless of what happens. If you're not comfortable with the ocean, and you're not a good swimmer, and you're not familiar with this environment, always swim where there's lifeguards. Like, they are looking out for you. They know where the rip currents are. If you get caught in one, they can get there to you and help you quickly. If you're not on a lifeguard beach, this is where this knowledge becomes so much more important in how to address what happens to you if you're caught in this.
Boy, that's really an important piece.
Yes.
But we have signs up on beaches here. It says this is a rip current, and they still have the same kind of parting of the waves, and we got to swim parallel. Even though I've been told in Hanalei there's a circular rip at Pine Trees, and Bruce Hopkins is going to be doing a rip current demonstration in two parts of the bay, which have different, I assume, will have two different kinds of rip currents. So you did this research and you used these trackers and you used people, and that was a while ago, right? And
Oh,
so
yeah. That's
it's,
many moons ago. Yes.
yeah, so are we making progress in understanding rip currents, do you think?
I think we made a significant progress in understanding the circulation patterns of rip currents, their behaviors, the temporal variability. Nothing more with that is required. The translation, the communication, and the impact of humans still needs work. And the science part is actually the easy part because we can put our equations to it. We have data. But humans are so, they're much more complex than the rip current. And why did person X, why were they okay and person Y wasn't? And you hear these anecdotal stories that confirm the circulation pattern, which is, and I've heard these a few times in Monterey where we have tourists, the kid or wife gets caught in the rip current, the dad, quickly, takes off some of his garments to jump in, and he's the one that ends up out to sea, and the kid was back at shore. Like the lifeguards are saving the dad more than the person who got caught in the rip current actually ends up back at shore most of the time. You hear this, like, or by the time they got help, the person was back on shore. So you hear this recirculation in these accounts. Now, why did that kid do the right things and someone else? And you hear a lot of times, unfortunately, it's the athletes that there seems to be more drownings with the athletes. You hear about this in Florida a little bit more, like college football player, college this, some, and then yet you hear these other bystanders that make it back. And so the complexity of the human in this and how we handle panic, I think is a bigger part of this equation that takes time, and some of this is the signage that we talk about, that it's, who saw that signage and thought it was, oh no, this is the most hazardous thing, and I ended up in it. I mean, as our generation, quicksand was the thing we worried about, and I've never encountered quicksand at all. I think rip currents kind of have become the quicksand, and we need to kind of show that it's reducing panic, giving action. I like Bruce's message of stay afloat. But unfortunately, the people that pass away from this, unfortunately, we don't know what happened. We don't know what created that negative outcome versus the positive outcome of someone else.
Well, that's a really good point. There, as it's been said, I think at the USLA conference on that they had in Waikiki, that maybe there's 150 fatal drownings from rip currents, but the non-fatal ones, like almost 50,000 people a year.
Yeah,
So,
we overlooked that.
right.
And the thing is, when I first start, before we had this knowledge, and before we had the sort of instrumentation, we were studying the drownings at Florida. So all the beaches around the Daytona area. And I can give you the best predictive index of drowning without knowing the waves, which are There's more rescues over the weekend. There's more rescues on holidays. There's more rescues on warm days. Basically, rescues scale with population. The more people on the beach, the more rescues, which just says the underlying thing is there's always a rip current.
Right.
It's just when the population gets larger, now you have more people potentially entering the rip current, not knowing or not comfortable, and then the beach go the lifeguards have to rescue someone. The main thing with knowing that knowledge for the lifeguards in Florida is that they're properly staffed to handle the population. So if it's a busy week, now there's anomalies in all of that data, which are when there's swell. And that creates the groupiness, so those like perfect ocean days and the waves are coming in and they're building and people are surfing, and those create the largest temporal variability and give beachgoers the confidence that the ocean is not hazardous. And then all of a sudden, the set waves come in, they lift people up, and you get more rescues. And again, that's more of a social thing of pet people felt comfortable. They weren't worried, and they just ended up in scenarios that didn't realize they were in a rip current. And this temporal variability all of a sudden created an outbreak in rip current rescues.
So explain that again. When the swells come, I'm confused here. You mean when the waves are up and people are surfing?
So when there's long period waves,
Okay.
and I'm a very long period, you get so you hear surfers always say waves come in packet, the seventh wave is the best wave, and then the idea is that there's a groupiness to the wave pattern.
Okay.
When you have very long period swell, that groupiness goes from, on a normal day, the groupiness is on the order of, say, 2 minutes. So every 2 minutes, there's a set wave, and 2 minutes later, there's a lull. With very long period waves, that changes to like 5 minutes or 10, like,
Right.
and what happens is people see a lake. And they go into the lake because the waves are small and they don't realize it. But 10 minutes later, there's this large set. And that variability of just the ocean, if it's inviting to people and they feel safe, not that they have the experience, they go into scenarios that they shouldn't. And when you have these longer set waves, there's a long period where the ocean looks inviting until it's not inviting. And waves are actually more of the issue because they knock people over, they pick them up off the sand, and all of those things create the scenario where they're in deeper water. They got moved from the shallow water shoal to the rip channel. So this social thing is difficult, but then recognizing the environment is changing pretty dramatically as well.
Yeah, you've made good points. The ocean is variable. It's not a static piece. And that people who understand the ocean, have awareness, are safer. And one of the cultural pieces, we have a Hawaii water safety plan, of which this show was started, because we have the second highest drowning rate in the country. Our kids, 1 to 15, have a high rate of drowning, and snorkeling is the key.
Oh, yeah.
Reason the visitors are drowning here. So there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, but in Hawaiian culture, people who are Hawaiian and have grown up here, they respect the ocean. And that means spending time, 20 minutes, looking at the ocean, looking at what's happening, talking about wave patterns, which you're exactly right, because it could be calm, and then all of a sudden there's a whole group of waves that are bigger. And so you have people that come here to visit, or people are local that don't know much. It's a nice day. We have warm, weather here. The ocean's beautiful. It's just enticing, but there needs to be a respect. And in the messaging, as you say, we need to teach people that they need to be educated about the ocean, not to be fearful of it, because the more education, the more they can control how they behave. But what I see happening, and I'm glad Bruce is coming because it'll be an educational messaging, just like what you've done, Dr. McMahon. But we're going to use Bruce from Australia, and he's going to take the Okinawan lifeguards, which we collaborate with, to go in the rip. And hopefully we can come with some new messaging. But what the guards here tell me, which I have interviewed, they really want people to come and talk to them. And they don't. And so, as one of the girls, we only have four female guards on Kauai. So I interviewed them all, and they almost, in a funny way, said, maybe this should be like Disney World. They have to come and talk to a lifeguard before they get on the beach. They cannot put their things down until we tell them, here's where the rip is. If you're going to surf, you should surf by the pier. That's the place to surf. All those things that would give them information about the ocean before they even got it, even for locals, right? What are the conditions today? So.
I think we're getting better with that because
Good.
this was non-existent many a long time ago.
Yes.
I know when you fly into Australia,
Okay.
they now have a rip current video, like when you're kind of approaching arrival and that last little bit, they turn the movies off. So,
Okay. You've just made an exciting point. So tell me what they do.
well, they're just trying to get people. You, the unfortunate part is in our culture today, even when you buy the most complex thing of an iPhone, a whatever widget, there's the long instructions and there's the short instructions. And the short instructions are five cartoons, do this, do that, do that. And only if this doesn't work and break do you go to the long instructions. Unfortunately, beachgoers kind of see the simple instructions, get caught in the rip current, and at that point, they want the long instruction. But at that point, you've missed the opportunity for the long instruction. Hotels, we have to somehow find this like medium that is like intermediate instructions.
Right.
We need to do better of YouTube videos. See, this is where we kind of deviate from the science world and the public world, but there's really not much money out there, but I should be doing YouTube videos, and we need to be working with people that can make something, because I'm not an expert at a YouTube video,
Right.
and I'm not really the person that should be doing the YouTube video. I should be working with someone to ensure it's
It's able to, right.
accurate enough.
Okay.
And they need to pop up on the Instagram. They need, like, there's vehicles to get communication better. And some of it may be, like you have to read this to understand. I also think it should be part of the educational system in general.
Yes.
And further inland you are, the more you need the education. I thought about this at one point when I was heavily doing this research in the swim power, like, everyone knows in a fire, stop, drop, and roll. We somehow need more of this that they hear when they're younger. Everyone loves the ocean. Everyone talks about the ocean. I think at that age, you can introduce kids to what the ocean is so that by the time they're adults, they've seen and heard this before at a time that they're captive. It's the parents that are probably the biggest, they're the ones that need to explain to the kids because the kids don't know any better. And if the parents aren't creating the educational environment for the situation, how do we that like that's like we gotta like think that's where the social part is thinking about, well, it's not the kids. We need the parents to ensure that the kids understand. And but if the parents don't understand, how do we create this good communication circle? Or we start with the kids and their education, and they tell the parents, hey, I learned about rip currents at school today. Did you know? I mean,
Those are two very good points. And within the 6 months I've been doing this show, we're excited to hear that we've been trying to get water safety back into the schools here. It should be a state priority. I mean, one life, losing one life is not is should never happen.
yes.
And the traumas around all that and the resources that are put in every day for lifeguards and first responders to deal with things. So we've been pushing and pushing and pushing. And we just heard that the Hawaii Lifeguard Association, the Ben Carlson Foundation, which you're probably aware of, is going to fund a pilot study here for second graders in water safety education that is going to be run by the lifeguards. So,
Great.
that's a start. The other thing that I've run across is, Dave Samuels with Surf Life Saving in Brighton and Exeter started a program called Sandhoppers. And this sounded like a really brilliant program because what you're saying is true. If the parents are afraid of the ocean, the kids are going to be afraid of the ocean. If they don't have ocean experience, it becomes really a problem. So he started a program for kids and their parents. And it's water survival, getting in the ocean together, going underwater together, doing all these fun things together as a parent and a child. I thought that was really a great idea.
Oh yeah. And it'll I believe once you start doing this, it'll take off because the positive outcomes are easily to demonstrate. It's just creating, we got to get the right vehicles that make it accessible. So if you come up with the right aquatic research program, and again, the technology's out there to make it captivating. Once all the pieces are together, then I think it's easy to just get it into other hands and get it to spread. And then we just need someone famous to say,
Right.
hey, I saw this amazing YouTube video on rip currents. And before long, it's like everyone watched it. And then we need people to watch it again. And
Well, the example you told me, it was a flying into Australia. What airline was it? Do you know?
oh, this is a long
Okay.
time ago.
Yeah.
But I think they were trying to make it part of their policy for people. And I mean, Hawaii is a good example. California, any coast
Right.
should have this. Hotels, they should be running it. They should have a monitor going on in the hotel that's just running a loop nonstop with easy access to just grab the pamphlet to read more. But all those things cost money, and that, that's another part of this equation of how do you get the resources to ensure. And then we talk about the success. So 50,000, 500,000 people didn't get in a rip current. You're never going to be able to show that. Like, that's the other hard part is that when you're successful, other than showing no drownings, it's hard to recognize that the impact. And that'll be the other part of this of like, why do we still have this TV running with this loop and this brochure? And there's
Well, I think you're
challenges
right.
in this.
We have to think about how we do the messaging, and we're going to try to get the airlines to have something back on again. That's one of the things we're working on. And I think the second grade pilot program will be good. There's a pilot program that's being run by Dwayne DeSoto on Oahu, And I think your article that came out in Outside Magazine was great because everything you know about surviving rip currents is wrong. It was a great title. It was a
Well,
great
that
title.
wasn't me. That was the.
I know, but you're in that article, and I think everybody needs to know that that rip currents are complicated. But Mike Tipton, who is part of the Physiological Institute in Exeter, UK, has a program, and he's done a lot of research about floating and how that saves lives. So they have run a campaign that we were part of last year called Find Your Float. And so what he's saying, because he does all that research, it's the gasp response. People panic, they take in water, and that's a problem. When I asked people in my canoe club, we're going to be part of this, let's float, a lot of people didn't know how to float. And Bruce will say, it doesn't have to be this star angel piece. You could be just using your hands to scull, or maybe just breaststroke because you're getting your head above the water and moving slowly, right? But people were going, I don't know how to float. So that's a panic response, right? You're going to say, find your
You bring
float.
up a good point with this, and this is off the cuff.
Okay.
And this was the thing that, so I got in a little bit of an argument with C. Grant and my colleagues. So they thought they came up with something catchy, but it was non-informative, meaning break the grip of the rip. And I'm like, one, it doesn't grip you, you're trying to break it. And what is the action item? And I think you were right in saying, like, stay afloat is active, but again, it doesn't give you information. It just says float, but if you don't know how to float, so it needs to be doggy paddle, like some action, like they may not know breaststroke, but it needs to be other than float or with float that gives information of move your arms and float. Like, so there is some other piece to this because if you don't know how to float, then that information isn't helpful. But
Right. So I thought Mike Tipton's "Find Your Float" was a good action statement. In other words, everybody will float differently. If your head's above the water and you're going with the flow, maybe my float's different than yours. But you're right. I don't know.
yeah, I think it's great. That's the right direction, but I think it needs something else because, again, we get naive in our language because we're comfortable with the ocean and we think stay afloat, even if it's different. We're all gonna do a mechanism to get there, but I think we need to say that mechanism, like, and that needs to be on the brochure of
Yes.
arms moving,
Yes.
kicking to represent what float is because most people won't know that. And there's not a lot of people that go to the ocean aren't swimmers. And so I think there's another piece with that as well, is how many people are comfortable swimming. But I
Right.
think it's these things, these visuals that need to happen that give action. And I like to stay afloat, but I think you got to show arms.
Well, maybe, and I'm pretty sure with Bruce's demonstration, we'll get those visuals of people coming out because he's done it in Australia. And then they're asked, what happened to the people? How did you feel? What did you do? And all that to me is exactly what you're saying. We need to give people examples of how it feels to be in a rip. The only person I can say that came close to saying what you're saying is Ian Couch, who is the water safety officer for the world's toughest row. You've heard of that. They come to Kauai, they come from over at Newport or someplace nice like where you are, and they row across the Pacific Ocean and they end up places they go to Atlantic. So I had him on the show and I go, how do you keep people safe? There's no escort boats. He says, well, use a term called emotional inoculation. So we train emotionally for people to understand what they could be up against, right? So if it happens, they're prepared. So they're not panicking. So maybe that's what we're doing instead of making people fearful, going, this is, as you've said, this is what happens. This is how you can, this is the information you need to get back to the beach so it doesn't become this fearful thing. But I think it's a process. But
It is a process.
the more information we can give people, the more we can get people to go to lifeguarded beaches, the more we can get the dialogue between ocean professionals and the people being in the ocean, I think the more we'll get a better understanding and keep people safer, is my understanding.
And again, we are in a society that likes reward instead of tasks. And so again, the kids get a trinket, a slushie, or whatever, if they, with the parents, fill out, like, answer simple questions. Like, reward people tend to do versus task. And that's something, how to make it. Yes, you're saving your life and your family's life should be most important. But I think sometimes, you have to dangle a carrot, and it's the better thing in the end.
Right. And I think what you said about we understand how to take care of ourselves in a fire drill. We understand how to stay safe in a car with a seatbelt. We now need to have those kinds of things in place for water safety. So
Yes.
it's just common, it just is something, a reflex. You know exactly what to do. So we're working all on the same thing. And Dr. McMahon, if we start to do more videos and we need to make sure we're getting the right information, we're going to call on you to collaborate.
Yeah, happy to do it. I appreciate you reaching out. I appreciate you pushing the messaging and collecting this information and getting people aware, because that's fundamental in all this. I
Yeah.
did the easy part. You're doing the tough part.
No, you've done great work, and we really
Thanks.
appreciate it because up until this point, since I've been doing the show, I've learned so much myself, and other people who listen to this show are learning also, and that's the whole point of the show, to get research-based evidence, right?
Yes.
So informs people to be safer in what they're doing in the ocean. Because people travel, they're not just here, they go all around the world. They need to understand the ocean and respect it.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming. Jamie McMahon's work, listeners, reminds us that rip currents are not just a physical hazard, they're a human one. Understanding how people perceive risk, respond under stress, and interpret safety message can be the difference between survival and strategies. So I think that we thank you for sharing your insight with us today on Deep Dive into Water Safety. And thank you for showing us that the information that you've gathered, that rip currents are complicated, but if we understand the ocean and we educate ourselves and go to lifeguarded beaches, talk to the lifeguards, and try to learn as much as we can, we don't have to fear the ocean. We can be something that we can really enjoy. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.